You're listening to Around Comics, episode 191. Chicago, this is Around Comics, the comic culture podcast, where each week our revolving panel of guests talk about everything in and around the world of comic books and comics culture. And Around Comics is recorded at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by. And this episode is sponsored by InStockTrades.com, where waiting for the trade has never been easier. InStockTrades.com offers a huge selection of the collected editions you need. And right now, InStockTrades.com is offering our book of the month, The Starman Omnibus Volume 1, for an amazing 37% off the cover price. At last, the hit series created by James Robinson and Tony Harris is collected in a series of six spectacular hardcover editions. This inaugural volume features a new cover by Harris and collect Starman issues 0 through 16.
Best zero issue ever.
Well, you know what? We finally get to talk about that because this is our Book of the Month episode covering Starman Omnibus Volume 1. And like I said, if you're playing at home with the playing along at home with the single issues,
it is home version of the Around Comics.
It is issues 0 through 16. I'm Christopher Niesman. Let me introduce you to this star-studded DC extravaganza panel that we have.
Experts.
It is. It is podcast
sacks,
luminaries here.
People with lots of free time all around.
and the king of lots of free time is Around Comics regular and resident DC expert. He's also the host of Tom versus the JLA. He's Mr. Tom Caters.
Hey, thank you. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
All right.
I feel like I'm looking at my grandfather with a head mic on, his new glasses, and he's just like.
We've got a new recording
set up.
Yeah,
new mics, baby.
So, yeah, everybody's got the Madonna set up today with the headsets and microphones. It's very disorienting.
You refer to it as Tom-proof because I can't, like, forget that I'm talking, like, and back away or start leaning back.
You can, like, get up and walk around now.
Yeah, I can, yeah.
Smoking.
And speaking of Matt, next we have one of our longtime forum posters who has actually just joined the ranks of podcasters. He has a Starman-specific podcast called The Shades Journal, so we figured he'd be a good guy to have on a Starman-specific episode. He's Mr. Matt Kramer.
Hello. Thanks.
It's great to have you, man.
You're probably rolling in all that podcast money at this point.
Oh, right? Yes. The lucrative podcasting
money. Yeah,
addition to the house go well?
Yes.
House. He lives in a dirigible now.
We now have 17.
He doesn't need to stay in one place.
And if you are a DC fan and a listener of podcasts, chances are you are subscribed to Raging Bullets. And we are overjoyed to have Mr. Sean Whelan from Raging Bullets here tonight.
Thank you, Chris, for having me.
That's great. That's cool. It's good to have you. I think the last time we saw each other was New York?
Yeah,
was that,
absolutely.
Okay, and this is...
Did you see Chris throw up on the street?
I think he missed that one.
No, he didn't. Okay, good.
This is...
We actually got more traffic, too, so...
Yeah. Look, Niesman's throwing up. Let's go over there. Oh, maybe we shouldn't.
Podcasting star vomiting.
This is 3 years in a row, and Jim is here as well. He's kind of off to the side of the table, just kind of... looking at
it. We'll let him.
You slapped him already.
Yeah, it's not the case on your show. You know, we put the disclaimer out there whenever you guys came in that this is not going to be a 4-hour show.
No.
I have no notes.
Jim picked up a Marvel book and Sean slapped it out of his hand and said, No. You have a lot of reading to do, son.
Well, I'm a taskmaster.
This is the third or fourth year in a row that you've come into Chicago for Wizard World Chicago.
Yeah. Okay. It's the third year that I've known you.
Yeah, yeah.
David Price and I came in together 3 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And that was when we met you and we had a wonderful day.
Mm-hmm. going around. I puked on the sidewalk that show.
Yeah. I sense a theme.
There's a sadness to your convention stories.
That's always.
There's a specter of alcoholism that hangs over you. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, let's get to today's subject, and that is the Starman Omnibus, and it is a beautifully collected hardcover edition, and that's kind of where I wanted to start before we actually talk about what's in the book. And oh, by the way, it's common sense, but probably bears stating that if you haven't read the Omnibus, you may want to come back after you have, because we're going to spoil the crap out of it. You guys, as longtime DC fans, and all three of you as fans of Starman, and me never having read it, it's one of those that a lot of fans of the book were always recommending. It was, you have to read Starman. You really need to check this out. And it was really difficult to either find all the single issues, and in the trades, you could get the first two trades, but the third trade has been out of print for quite a while. So when they announced this omnibus and the series of, would it be omnibi? Is that the plural?
Yeah.
That is going to collect the entire series. What was your feeling or reaction whenever they announced that series of collections?
I thought it was good news for the people who hadn't read it and wanted to, because, yeah, like you said, it was notorious about not having everything collected, and stuff was out of print. Key issues weren't even included in the trades. None of the Shades journals had been collected. None of the Showcase 95 and 96 issues had been collected.
Tom looks on nostalgically.
I was pissed because I knew I wouldn't be able to sell my volume 3 trade for as much money.
Speculating. How about you, Sean?
You know, for me, it was very similar to what Matt was saying. It was, my hope was that everything would in fact be included, especially the Shades Journal, because the joy of the Shades Journals, which will be coming in later volumes of this, is that it makes you feel like you're Jack. You know, which Jack's the everyman. And that's part of the joy of reading this book, is we can all on some level to relate to Jack's journey, because we've all been at that point where we're unsure of ourselves and unsure of that next stage in life. So when this was going to be collected, I'm like, everybody's got to get all of it. You know, everything that went along with the whole experience of following Jack, which led to JSA and bigger stories. So.
Sure. Yeah, you're going to get a lot. I think as people read this, though, you're going to get a lot of the thing that always drives me insane, you know, when people talk about Watchmen and they're like, I skip the pirate parts and the text pieces, and I always scream. So I say, it's just as you didn't read the whole book then, you know. So it's fine, because when I remember that when I first started reading it, I think I skipped like the first couple of Shades journals just because I was like, eh, well, whatever, they're just like text pieces in the back.
It's all supplemental.
Well, whatever, I'm too cool for that. And then I finally figured out that they're actually important to the story, so. It's going to be interesting to see people's reaction to sort of a very non-linear, non-traditional way of introducing story concepts into something. I mean, that's not the way most comic books will introduce things, is that backwards sort of way of hinting at something and then paying it off later, but hinting at it in a text piece that eventually starts to tie together.
Sure,
we'll get into that.
This book... I, like a lot of other people in the 90s, it kind of bailed out in, 90, 92, 93, whatever. And it seemed like, you know, on the, you know, the upper crust of what was coming out comic wise, it was, a lot of stuff that drove people out of the hobby. I think Starman, and you look at other stuff like Sandman and a lot of the stuff that was going on in independent comics, that's really where kind of the next wave of really inventive and quality comics were. And Starman, that started in 94?
Yes, exactly.
Right around Zero Hour.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, Zero Issue, baby.
October 94.
So I think that people that refer to the 90s and that broad sweeping, it was a bad decade for comics. This is, I think, a really good example of some of the good stuff that was going on, and it's maybe because it was Robinson's ability to grab onto legacy characters and really mine DC's history and kind of reinvent it. And I don't know if anybody, and you guys obviously know more than me, had anyone before Robinson really mined DC's legacy and history like he had?
I don't know what I'll go first here. I think one of the strengths of what Robinson did was, I always got the feeling that after Crisis on Infinite Earths, that DC was weirdly embarrassed by the Justice Society and Golden Age concepts and, like, wanted to shuffle. I mean, they made the Justice Society disappear. I mean, they put him in limbo, literally. They, like, made him be like, all right, there you go, and so long. And whenever you'd see any of those concepts come back around, like Dr. Fate or any of it, it was always... Like, you know, there was the doctor, there was the Fate, who was the guy who had, like, a sword. You know, it was just the, in name.
Those old Golden Age characters weren't edgy enough for them.
Yeah, I think they had a weird, I don't know if it was embarrassment, an infatuate, it was a perceived weakness that was actually a strength. Because I think a lot of times you see people get freaked out about history to characters like, oh, you need to know everything about every character and you can't have any, everything has to be in on the ground floor. And I think... They sort of perceive that as a weakness when really it was something that could be a strength, like that was used in this book. So.
When did Robinson do the Golden Age?
93.
Okay, so it was a precursor to this?
Oh, yes.
You know, and I would suggest anyone that's reading the Omnibus and enjoys Starman, I was reading the Golden Age at about the same time. Mm-hmm. And the voice in both of those comics is so strong. And if you enjoy Starman, I would 100% suggest reading the Golden Age, maybe even reading the Golden Age first.
And there's even specific references in the Omnibus to events that occurred in the Golden Age.
Even though it was a quote-unquote an Elseworlds mm-hmm. tale.
Yep.
Now, did that start as an Elseworlds? I mean, we're sidetracking into
I believe Golden Age. Yes.
Okay, it was. Okay. But parts of it, I think, have been... Like, you know, Ted Knight's mental breakdown has been something that they've folded into the actual, mm-hmm. you know, right. actual history of it.
And the incidents in Washington.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it's sort of hinted at, but, you know, with any reference to your Golden Age story, it's got a lot of, you know, don't pull at the threads.
Too hard.
Robinson had a nice time gap that he could play with where Starman was off camera in the DCU, so he did. And kind of wove in the stuff from Golden Age as being events that happened when the other Starmen were in place. And that was how he explained that those events actually did happen. So it wasn't so much that he put the whole Golden Age in continuity as much as he took the things from Starman that he really wanted to use within this volume and made them continuity. He crafted it really quite well, where anybody who would say, but that couldn't happen and all that, he explained it along the way. No, yes, it could, and this is how it did. So, which was really nice for longtime readers.
I imagine a lot of spreadsheets.
Roy Thomas-like spreadsheets and where you can... What week you can jam something into during World War II.
That's what you all do with all the All-Star Squadron, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, those literally take place between... other stories. So, sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a history of doing that, but there's a huge historical gap, you know, after World War II, where you saw the Justice Society once a year when they would show up with the Justice League. But, I mean, really, nothing, you know, of tremendous significance. I mean, it was cool to see him and you'd have little character moments, but it's not like you learned what Jay Garrick was up to. You know, in that year since, so there's a huge gap of, like, time where they were around, but really they weren't the driving, there's no stories really about what they were doing. Mm-hmm. They just would show up and it'd be cool. But mm-hmm. so there's a lot of space for Robinson to go in. And...
Well, let's actually get into the story a little bit and set it up. You know, basically the story starts with a new Starman in the Opal City, which we'll definitely talk about. Opal
City.
You only
have an hour, Chris. I leave in exactly 1 hour.
We have T minus 52 minutes and counting.
I got time.
But kind of talk about the setup and where the story starts and as we're introduced to a new Starman on the scene in Opal City. And he is Starman, I guess, has always been the hero of Opal. Is that correct?
And Opal City will... I don't believe it existed before this series.
I
think he created it for the series.
God, it doesn't feel like it.
In the Golden Age, I just read the Golden Age Starman archives, and it's never actually named the city where Ted Knight is operating. It's kind of implied that it's New York, but it's never specifically named.
And the city kind of from the get-go creates its own character. You know, Robinson creates this character of Opal City, and it's important. Why is Opal so important in Starman?
I think, well, Robinson talks about it in the back. One of the things that he really treasured about DC was that it had cities like Gotham, Metropolis, which, yes, you can sort of find, you know, Metropolis as kind of any big major city, but there are unique qualities that are exclusive to Metropolis, unique qualities to Gotham. You look at the Flash, you know, the multiple cities that the Flash is operated out of, depending if you're talking about Jay Garrick or Wally West and Barry Allen, you know, they have their unique nature as well. He wanted to do the same thing with Opal City. This was his chance to kind of craft that city and give it that unique DC feel and pull off the heritage that makes a DC book unique, whereas Marvel books tend to be grounded more in the real world.
And well, they're all hanging out in Manhattan.
They're all in Manhattan. That's one of the things.
And I don't mean that as a knock.
No,
it's
not
actually
at all.
Kind of what he was saying. His whole point was it is that unique nature that makes it nice to read different things between both countries.
Everyone gets their city, all right? Everyone has a city.
I've really grown to appreciate that in D.C., and it makes sense. I mean, if you think about a big, wide world, and there's 20 major cities in the United States, well, yeah, each city is going to need its champion. They're not, you know, all the bad shit doesn't happen in Manhattan. You know, it's
some bad shit does
some bad shit,
there,
but
right?
I mean, you got the north side of St. Louis to worry about, you know,
the north side of, yeah. What sort of hero would St. Louis have?
Aquaman,
folksy, yeah. Aquaman,
yeah, he would
come right up the river, yeah, from New Orleans, yeah, yeah. That'd be his city, he'd sink it.
But it's Opal becomes its own character, and it's very important in the Mr. Shade's journal over here. Obviously, the Shade is very, very popular character for you and one that you hold dear. And it seems like the Shade almost holds Opal to a level of reverence more than anybody else in the book.
Right, and that's, as we were talking about earlier, that's something that really comes out in the Shade's journal. That gives his past with the city, and all of the times past issues show, most of them show the Shade in Opal City as he's writing, because he's been there since 1883, 1882, I believe, whatever the... I don't know if it says in the table of contents. For a long time.
Yeah, he's been there. He's been there.
Oh, yeah,
for,
it's right
for,
there, 1882.
And he's
putting him.
The one thing that I love about the Shade in this is it's about, to him, it's about home.
Exactly.
And when somebody comes to your home and violates your home, you're going to take things that are at your root core of your character, and you are going to change them to protect your home. And he does that throughout this story. And in many ways, it makes him, you can relate to this person who's typically throughout history been this very strong villain. You can now relate to him in a very different manner because his home is being violated multiple times, where he now has to take on a role that he clearly is not always comfortable with. And it adds just a different dimension to his character, makes him a little bit more three-dimensional, a little more human. In a way, especially considering, that his powers are way out there.
Yeah, well, and kind of from the beginning, you get a feeling that he's not necessarily a good guy. He's not necessarily a bad guy. He's not even really Opal's protector, but how would you describe his relationship with the city and what he does in the series of this first omnibus to be, you know, kind of like this force in Opal?
He's trying to connect with, first of all, he connects with Opal, as I mentioned, as home, but he's also trying to connect with a piece of Opal's past in its hero and that legacy. He's looking for Scalp Hunter, which he references, and he's assuming in this volume that we're talking about that Scalp Hunter's Jack. And even in his questioning of Jack, when they have that communication, he's asking him questions. Do you remember a past as being an Indian? Do you remember, and he's really digging into the root of saying, you know, do you remember having a previous life? And he's looking for that person and trying to reconnect with that person. And it's actually, that's a really important part for people that are continue following this. There is a lot in this volume that is set up to things that don't even pay off until later issues. And that's the nice part. This story was crafted by an author who had a game plan that he wanted to follow all the way through. Mm-hmm. And it is nice to see this. It's a different, very different kind of storytelling than we're used to nowadays, in this fact that, you know, we're used to creative teams jumping. You know, after a certain amount of time,
sure.
It's very rare for us now to see somebody have 80 issues on a book.
Brian K. Vaughan with Y.
Right, or, exactly.
You know,
it's
a rarity. It's celebrated now.
But when you get that, you know, you've got an author who's really invested in telling a big story with big events and multiple chapters, and he sets up a lot of his chapters along the way in a way that it's actually worth, when you're done reading all of these volumes, to go back and reread it again, and things will start clicking. You're like, oh, my gosh.
I forgot how much setup there was for things later, because when you're reading it, I mean, stuff. Some of that doesn't come up for 4 years, you know, some of the stuff that's brought up. And I was going to say, the thing that strikes me about The Shade is that he seems like he's a sad, bored person. You know, he's someone who's been around for a really long time, and he doesn't have, I mean, he's not somebody, he seems like he's somebody who thinks he knows everything, he's seen everything, he doesn't really have friends. Mm-hmm. You know, not really. Everyone's at a distance, you know, like even his villainy seems to be more based solely on the fact that he's got nothing to do. He's not going to die. He's not going to, you know, what else is there to do?
Well, there's a story where it seemed like he had friends in the past, but I'm sure he got probably tired of all of his friends dying.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think there's a sense of that to his character of like he just seems really lonely. You know, and you see that as it goes on in the story, is that he kind of does, he wants to connect with people. Like you said, he was looking for his old, you know, his old friend. He just doesn't have anyone. When you see him, he seems to be, you know, he's supposed to be this aloof character, but he's really like alone a lot of times when you see him. He's alone, like writing, or he's alone. He shows up to talk to Jack and then disappears, but he's not going back to somebody else, you know. That's his contact with humanity, really, is somebody.
When you see his times past with Oscar Wilde, you get to see him look at a home that for him was very important in the past that had changed. And he talks about that in his inner dialogue, how that home changed for him. And I think that's why that's a good setup piece to get kind of an eye on what The Shade's doing and what that's important to him, is that he doesn't want this to happen to Opal. He's seen it happen before.
Okay.
And it's really cool how Robinson wasn't afraid to delve way into a character's past and devote whole issues to that. To give you kind of an insight. It's why I think these characters, this book still has that, after all these years, I read all 80 issues when it came out, and this is a book I consistently talk about with people that you need to read because of the fact that they're characters that are important to me.
You're one of those guys.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
It was also a great way to give Tony Harris time to catch up.
Have
an issue or two a year where Tony Harris isn't doing the art, so.
And it totally fits because you can do a fill-in artist there because you're setting a different tone, a different atmosphere, and everything, and that's fantastic. And you're right, and that's a brilliant way to handle that without it being jarring to the reader who's reading it monthly.
Sure. It feels natural.
Yeah.
Sure. I think it's a testament that we can spend that much time talking about a villain who's maybe not even the villain. He's a very ambiguous character.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you read on, you'll see
his motivations.
Yeah, and he's very complicated.
Even set up in this volume.
Complicated villains are the best villains. It's the you know, run in, shoot or smash villains
because
they're evil. That's not that engaging.
And doing Tom versus the JLA, I read, you know, some JLA JSA crossover where The Shade appears in it. It's really funny when you read this happens a lot with villains, you know, when someone's been around for 50 years, you know, like Captain Cold or The Shade, but no one's really ever done anything with them besides have them show up and fight the good guy and then disappear for a year. And then when it's that character's turn to show up again, you bring him back. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's always funny when you get someone who writes him really well, and then you go back and you read the older original stuff, and you're like, oh, this isn't The Shade. You know, like, this isn't the same
quite the rough draft.
The original, it's like, oh, that's how strong that character can be.
Sidebar, can you, not now, but a little bit later, can you explain to me Black Canary's whole origin story again and, like, the body switching? That's where I am in JLA. And
I'll draw you a graph.
And a little disturbed.
It's a little disturbing. That's for a different topic for a different show.
She's her own mother.
Yeah, that's weird.
You had mentioned, actually, like every time that we talk about this book leading up to this episode, you say best Zero issue ever. Why?
Because it made sense. There's the actual beginning.
Because it mattered.
At the same time when Zero happened, the Aquaman series was at like issue 4, and then the next issue was a Zero issue. Mm-hmm. It was like, really? You need to have like, you've only had 4 issues and you're already like,
really,
this is the defining.
This?
Yeah. And most Zero issues, I know the idea. If you read comics in the 90s, the Zero issue was that issue that was supposed to trick you into thinking that this is going to be a great jumping on point. But for a lot of them, they were just really they weren't done very well.
No, it didn't matter.
They were kind of watered down, like versions of the character. You know, that just sort of. If you read the Zero issue and then you read the next issue, there wasn't any guarantee that Zero issue was going to give you any clue onto what's going on. I mean, some were done well, but what's great is this was a Zero issue that actually started. You know, it was a start to a longer story, and it made sense, and there was a reason for it to be there.
I wonder why it wasn't just issue 1, because it reads as issue 1. Because
it's 0 hour.
The entire
line had a Zero issue. So Batman did Detective Comics, you know, straight on through. Yeah.
It was just kind of fortunate that this start happened to start at 0 hour.
4 or 5 characters, and I'm just throwing this.
They had
they relaunched. I think it was Fate, one of them.
Fate, Manhunter, Primal Force, and Xenoverse. Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why you don't remember.
You don't remember Xenobrood?
I'm like, Xenobrood? Oh, yeah. But that's why it's a Zero issue. I mean, it's one of those classic sort of 90s things, like the -1 issue.
And admittedly, I wasn't reading the entire line then, so I mean, it's like, you're right. There's a reason why I don't remember.
Yeah.
This was a book that, right away from the poster, the character looked cool. When I read Zero Hour, they had Jack in there.
Yeah.
Really quick. You know, it was a very short thing with David and his father. And, you know, which led right into this. So, I mean, there's nothing that you're missing. They even reference it in here.
He just shows up saying, I
hope I don't have to be stuck, you know, or something like, you know.
But I figured, you know, I'd try the Zero issue and see if it was any, I mean, there was something, the costume looked cool, you know, they had, because the poster that they showed him with the rod that we see him with in the later issues, the one that he kind of helped his dad craft and design. Mm-hmm. So he was an interesting looking character at a time. Yeah. In the 90s, it was like, okay, this is a hip character. They're going for something a little different.
Yeah, he wasn't spandex.
He didn't have a sword. He didn't have claws. He didn't have, you know, like, it was like
he wasn't covered in olive oil.
But it was hip in the sense that it looked like a person as opposed to just another guy with, you know, a sword or huge ripped muscles, or, you know, that it looked real, like a real person, how a real person would dress.
Well, Sean had mentioned it whenever we first started. So, you know, Jack is the everyman. He's, you know, how I think
he's a collector.
Yeah, he's how a lot of comic book fans probably would like to picture themselves as, you know, if I were going to be in the same situation or were going to be a hero, this is...
I'm
going to
sleep with a circus freak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love
it. Every comic book geek's dream. Tentacle girl.
That's the original tentacle porn.
Yeah,
right there.
Original. Yeah, that's the Japanese got that from this.
But then she even said that he doesn't have to stick around.
Yeah, that's the crazy part. She's like, all right, see you later.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it was basically, I'm looking for Mr. Wright, or Mr. Wright
right
now.
Yeah. When is he going to leave? God, he's hanging around all day.
You talk about the collector aspect, and that is something that I think that's very much a James Robinson thing. I think he talks about it in either the foreword or, mm-hmm. or the afterword. He talks about, you know, kind of his not compulsive collector mentality, but
like compulsive.
I mean, he loves old stuff. Mm-hmm. And
collectors are compulsive. That's why you collect. I mean, it doesn't mean that you're non-functioning the rest of your life, but to collect something, it has a component of
So you're saying that if you're like in the middle of a drag down knockout fight and you're actually thinking about this antique chair that you're going to be late trying to pick up, that's maybe a little compulsive?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, so there's a little James Robinson in Jack.
I've done that. I've thought about comic books I want to buy while I'm fighting on the streets.
It's also Jack's livelihood, though, which is an interesting concept because he knows that if because a lot of times he's racing for these things with other collectors who are looking to sell them in similar shops. Yeah. So in his case, he's going to be then, you know, if he misses, and he does miss deals inside this issue specifically because he has to make the right choice. Mm-hmm. So he does the right thing as a hero, but then he's like, oh, man, it, you know, I knew I could have sold this.
I love when he's explaining his business or a particular business deal to his dad, Ted Knight, and he's like, I forget what the items were, but it was basically, I can meet this guy on this part of town and buy like these antique records or something like that because I know that there's someone, you know, 10 miles out of town that I can swap these for like a bearskin rug and, you know, then trade it to someone else and sell that for tons of money in the shop. And it's like this, you know, complex trading, bartering, selling system that's what these guys do for a living. And
it's also cool. It's such a different type of job for a superhero because most superheroes, you know, if they don't have, if they're not rich,
independently
they're
wealthy,
scientists.
Or reporters.
Or cops.
Yeah.
You know, like, very rarely are they small business owners.
In the secondhand collectibles market.
The DC universe, not a whole lot of the heroes are small. Well, Green Canary, Green Canary. Black Canary, of course, owned a flower shop, small business owner.
Yeah, florist. I can see it. Yeah. But was that before she was, or after she was melded?
Always
with
her? It's a family of florists.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The funny part was Jack was so into antiques in the past in, you know, his job, but he was fighting against the traditions and the past of Starman.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Very early on, which was, it almost seems to be a contradiction, which he later realizes how right he was for this. But it was, and I love the bits where he can't admit it to his dad. You know, because
sure,
I think, you know, we've all been in that position with family at some point where you don't want to admit that they were right or you don't, you know, it's that independence, it's that defiance that we all have or have had at some point.
You were right are the three hardest words in the English.
You were right.
Exactly. And sometimes you get to that point where you're like, I wish I had said that, and the moment's passed. But, and Jack has a lot of those, which is one of the great things about him because he reads so real.
Well, I mean, this book opens up with a lot of sadness. It basically opens up with Ted's son and Jack's older brother, David, being shot and killed and you know, proving, you know, kind of right off the bat that he was not cut out to be Starman. It's like his first night as Starman. It puts it out there that it's very early.
The fans were pissed because a lot of people said that David Knight was their favorite Starman.
I'm sure someone did. You know, whenever someone dies, someone's like, he's my favorite character, even though he's appeared twice.
That was that person's first Starman.
That was that first Starman. He showed up for seven panels. I'm so angry.
Yeah, those appearances he had in the Will Payton series were so good.
Yeah, you know, whenever
why isn't
dies
he in the Starman cave? but it opens up with this tragic event for this family, and I've heard Matt describe Starman before as it's a story about fathers and sons and brothers, and that's really apparent right from the start about Jack's relationship with his brother and his father, and not always a good relationship.
Right.
It's a lot of, and you start to see it more and more is that Jack has a lot of qualities that Ted didn't have, and that he can't, you know, Ted says it, that Jack's all about aesthetics, and Ted was never about aesthetics. Mm-hmm. That was his mom. His mom was the one who was all about how things looked and like appearances and stuff. And there's a sadness also to sort of Ted Knight in the fact that he's obviously someone who's lost a lot of things. You know, he lost his wife. You know, he's lost his son. And he doesn't quite know how to connect to Jack. I mean, they love each other, but it's very apparent that they don't necessarily see things the same way. I mean, the part in the book where Ted, like, offhandedly remarks that he had dinner once with some, you know, painter, and, you know, Jack freaks up because it's one of his favorite painters. But, you know, the disconnect and being that Ted, you know, he would have no idea that that was something, his son would like. But you start to see them get closer and closer, and the it's like through the job that he inherited is how that they're starting to see each other. You know, the part where Jack says, you know, it felt really good to save people, and that was something they both could not. Ted could understand what Jack was feeling, and Jack could understand why his dad did what he did, and that was the bridge between them, was that being Starman was, you know, it's like if your father is in the mafia and then you're in the mafia, or your father's a ditch digger and you're a ditch digger. You know, that's the...
It even goes one step further, though, and you're 100% correct, but taking it beyond that, Jack is a constant reminder of the wife that was lost. Mm-hmm. Because even David references it later in those talking with David issues. If anybody liked the one presented in the Omnibus, the later ones get even better. Mm-hmm. That's not taking anything away with what was presented here. Mm-hmm. It's just something that is a consistent...
You heard Sean say, yeah, this one was the worst one.
You know? For somebody out there, it was their favorite.
Yes, that's true, because it was their first. And it was my first, too, but... The nice thing is you get to see that he is viewed as, you know, so much like the mother, but the dad almost is like putting up the blinders and doesn't want to remember that part of what he saw all along in Jack is the parts that were him, the parts that were like him. Mm-hmm. Jack fights against that too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't want to admit that he's so much like dad and that there are, you know, parts of him that are like that.
He remembers the past differently, where mm-hmm. there's scenes where he remembers that he's the one that said, "I want to be like that. I want to be like," even though he
through
likes
Viewmasters.
To. Yeah, he likes to. He in his, you know, 20s is like, "Oh, I don't want to do that." It's like when I went to college and I wanted to pretend like I didn't like the professional football, even though I was from Green Bay, and you have to like the Packers. And I was like, "Oh no, you know, professional sports. It's for the the proletariat, the common man, and I'm gonna be better than that." And then, you know. It was a losing fight, you know, but you like to remember.
Now you have Brett Favre underwear on.
I'm wearing it right now. I got a Brett Favre tattoo on my back, and he's riding an eagle. Flag. But you remember, it's the way you remember your past to fit what you think you are now. Sure.
Well, that was a big revelation in the book, is whenever he remembers that moment where he was playing Starman. He's like, no, I'm Starman, and, you know, fighting with his brother on who got to play dad, you know, and that was I think that was a huge moment for Jack in the book. You know, I think what's really important about those two characters, and there are three characters if you count with David, you know, from the beginning, David is in the exact same Starman costume that his father was, and he just can't be what his father was. But Jack, I mean, very reluctantly, out of necessity, says, "Okay, well, I'll do this for a little bit, but I'm not putting the tights on." And he creates this new kind of persona. It's not creating a persona. It's his Starman outfit, which really isn't an outfit, just reflects who he is as a person.
Totally awesome duster, man.
Yeah.
That's an outfit.
You know, he may be Starman, but he's not going to be his father's Starman. He's going to be his own Starman.
This isn't your dad's Starman.
This is not your dad's Starman. And that's kind of what James Robinson is saying. This is not your father's Starman.
And David is like the example in the whole piece, in the sense that David never has the opportunity to define his own identity. It was apparent that he was never cut out for the Starman role. His dad even knew it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that was one of the reasons why when David passed away, he was so angry with Jack. And it was because of the fact that he's like, you know, you were the one that should have been this person, not David. David was never meant for this. Right. And nobody knows what David was meant for, because David was never had that opportunity to find out who he really was. And, I mean, what a real-life story that is, because, I mean, you know, we all run through that where we got to find out who we are and what, you know, what keeps us going.
Yeah, tell me about it, man. Doing this show every week.
This is not my life, Tom.
I'm not meant to be doing this.
Let your family do before you.
Like my father
brother did a comic book podcast before me, and I was trying to take his.
Some family member out there that's supposed to be.
The other thing I really like, you know, now that we've talked about, like, the father and son, is how Robinson manages to get all the other star men that don't necessarily make a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, because you have something that happens in comic books when you have a name or, like, a perceived brand, but you don't necessarily like the old version. You know, you'll be like, oh, it's the late 70s. I'll have a blue-skinned alien.
Toyman.
Yeah. Yeah, every time, you know, someone will be like, ah, I'm going to do a Starman, but it's not going to, this isn't going to be your dad's Starman. This is going to be a blue-skinned alien. And then, you know, 20 years later, like, it's not your Starman.
Jeff Bridges shows up in this, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, then there's the Starman who's Will Payton, who got shot by some, like, energy beam and became Starman. But Robinson makes a really great effort, and I think Jeff Johns probably stole this part of James Robinson's mind of making it all fit together, so it all makes sense. They're all Starmen. They all have a tie to each other. They're all linked. They're not, you know, even the Prince Gavin Starman, who we see for like one panel in this one, you know, all the Starman.
And it works. It's okay. And they could actually have Sunday dinner with each other and get along, and it would be okay.
He makes the Starman of 1951 make sense.
Yeah, even though that's you haven't got there. Yeah, you'll get there.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, it's.
Oh, I forget. Yeah, it's not even. The Shades Journal isn't in this where he's first mentioned.
But, you know. You see it all the time. Johns does it really well now with most books. And just because there's 60 different versions of Toyman doesn't mean that you have to ignore all 60. You can, if you're thinking, and I'm pointing at my head. This is audio, so you can't see that. But
and there's
you can fit it all together.
Yeah, there's no reason that all 60 of those versions of Toyman can't be relevant and important in their own little way.
Yeah, same with Starman.
Where this is unique, though, and completely agreeing with that, is that Robinson obviously cared about this concept and these characters. And as he fleshed this idea out, he really wanted to show that this stuff is cool. And, I mean, I think you need a writer who wants to do that and has a desire to do that and has a connection with those characters in order to get that.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the things that Sal said, and I think he's almost
where
done
is he
reading it. Sal is I think at home with the kids tonight.
Oh,
yeah, reading them Spider-Man stories or something on those
Spider-Man rain, and that's Spider-Man's genitals.
No, actually I think he's saving up his energy for this weekend. He's ready to partay out in Rosemont.
It's gonna be trouble.
It's gonna be so much fun. I'm so excited. But Well, try not to puke on the first night. The book, it has weight, and this is something that Sal and I have been talking about.
It's heavy. The book's literally heavy.
It is. It's not, you know, 17 issues. James Robinson has a writing style, and he obviously researches and puts these things together. But he has, more than anything, he has a voice. And whenever you put this down, I tried to read an issue or two a night. I didn't want to read more than that because each kind of chapter in this story, it means something. There's weight to it, and you put it down, and you feel like you've read something, if not with importance, but it meant something. And I think this series, and I don't want to, you know. I have a bad habit of breaking into hyperbole and overstating things. It happens, Tom. But
this might be the greatest thing ever done ever
ever in the history of the world.
Hyperbole.
But no, I mean it has a voice. It has weight. It's, you know, and Robinson. I felt that way with the Golden Age. Is that he just has a way of adding weight to things that I think struck a chord with you.
He's really good at narration, mm-hmm. which is a strength and a weak. It can be a weakness at times, too, because...
too much narration can get very dry.
It can get very dry, and it can also, sometimes when you need to have a battle scene, and I think, you know, this kind of dovetails a little bit into what I want to talk about next, because, like, we've talked a lot about James Robinson, but I want to talk a little about Tony Harris, and that I love Tony Harris's work in the book, and I love James Robinson's narration, but sometimes, especially in the beginning, when I think they're still trying to figure out what they're going to do, there's battle scenes where it's a little, like,
too much narration and not enough actually seeing what's going on, and you're kind of like, how did that happen? You know, like, yeah. The core, and it gets better and better, but the, you know, the first couple ones, you're kind of like, you know, you can do with just a touch less narration during the battle scene and a little bit more of the visual, but they get better and better with that, especially Tony Harris's art. You know, you look at the first issue to the seventh issue. I mean, it's like,
oh gosh,
and it's night and day. You know,
look at this compared to like Ex Machina. I mean, talk about a guy that's changed styles over the last
Issue one to the cover. Yeah. Take a look at your cover and then take a look at your issue one.
That's Tony Harris.
They changed and it got better. They got both got better, I think, at getting the stories across.
Did you guys all get a chance to read the afterword?
Yeah,
not yet.
I read it on the plane.
Right. One of the cool things about the afterword in this book that I really like is it exactly what we're talking about here. And it's definitely worth reading. He goes into the relationship with Tony Harris, and you can tell that exactly what you're addressing is something that early on it was clear. If you read between the lines, that there was some headbutting. I'm not saying it, you know, was necessarily violent or anything, but the two of them were trying to find that right mixture for this book. And it does, I think, it feels like it pays off later.
Yeah.
The communication between the two, they found that happy medium, and he found that he had to respect what Tony brought to the table, and Tony found that, you know, and they found that point. But I liked the, it's one of the books, a lot of times I'm one, I gloss over forwards and afterwards. Mm-hmm. You know, typically I want to get into the story, I want to read the story and all that. This one, I really, for anybody who wants to get into the head of the writer, if you read this book and you kind of, if you're kind of like me and you skip those usually, I urge you to read them for this particular book.
The afterword's really good. The aborted foreword.
Yes.
Instead of getting too long. Not only does James Robinson like to narrate heavily his stories, but he likes to narrate heavily his own life.
Nice.
With a lot of detail.
And it was.
I had eggs for breakfast.
The foreword was brilliant, though, because that's where you get that story.
Started it, and someone, you can't do this. This is way too long.
It's 12 pages. It's half the book. We can't do this.
You can't do a forward that's eight pages long.
We will save it for the omnibus in 15 years. What's an omnibus? Oh, you'll find out. So you said you wanted to move into another.
Well, to sort of talk more about like the art and the sort of visuals of it. I mean, he talks about it in the afterword about the whole idea of how having Solomon Grundy be this gentle creature came from the way that Tony Harris draws Solomon Grundy, which is very different from, the long-haired, like, hippie Solomon Grundy. Usually see the, you know, my pants are too short, I got myself a crew cut.
Born on a Monday.
Give me some shrimp, you know. Solomon Grundy. So
Mike Norton Solomon Grundy.
Mike Norton.
Give me some scrimps.
Scrimps, yeah. But, I mean, looking at Tony Harris's artist, it gets, you know, better and better through the issues and closer and closer to his Ex Machina style, which actually,
it's not as
heavily
posed.
Yeah, would be my one thing that I think is better in this. I think it forces him at times to draw really fantastical things that I think he does really well. But I think in Ex Machina, it's not necessarily avoided, but the story never demands the sort of like a woman turning into smoke and going away, which is sort of, to me, the fun part of comics is the fantastical, you know. Not necessarily the talking heads all the time.
Sure.
You know?
Well, out of the 17 issues, we'll just kind of go around the table here. Is there one issue out of the 17 that you would say this is my favorite issue?
Matt Kramer, go.
Number seven.
Which one's number seven?
That was the first part of the circus story.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first issue of Starman that I read.
Okay, which is actually, if you look at it, that's after Jack has kind of taken the mantle, and it's his first kind of real adventure as Starman after he's kind of accepted that, you know, after the first one, it's like, okay, I might keep doing this for a little while.
Exactly, and I didn't read the first arc until probably a year later, because back then, the first trade didn't come out until 1996.
Oh, well.
DC wasn't always great about trading their stuff in a timely manner.
They're still not.
Still,
great.
They're getting better.
In Starman month.
Yeah, exactly.
But what else about that issue did you like?
Oh, it's basically everything you need to know about the book. I mean, it's got a good mix of action and humor, and just the art in it is great.
The collector aspect, because that's why he's out there. He's out there in the
exactly.
country.
You see the image of the old lady buried with an axe in her head.
It's nice.
It's kind of gory, man. I'm a little scared.
A little freaked out by what you like.
Yeah. How about you, Tom?
I forget what number it is. It's the one where Jack shows up to his dad's observatory wearing a ragdoll sweatshirt, and his dad is like, I told you why I don't like you wearing that sweatshirt. And he goes into the story about how, you know, ragdoll had led sort of like a murder spree in Opal City, and he and the JSA sort of ended up killing ragdoll, you know, and that's why he doesn't like him, you know, wearing that shirt.
Ragdoll's kind of the Charles Manson of the DC universe.
Yeah. In hindsight,
what an odd. When did they develop that whole cult leader aspect?
I think it's pretty much this.
Okay, because that stuck around. I'm trying to think the last time I've seen, was it...
the current ragdoll you see is like the sun or something. Right. It's not the...
Didn't Gail Simone do a story with the father ragdoll in either like a Secret Six or something?
Well, that's the current one that we're seeing that he's talking about.
Yeah.
Well, they've got that ragdoll, but I think she had his father in one of those issues, or
like in a flashback or something. Or?
I think he was in there.
That's now, did they address the whole cult leader, or I might be thinking of like a JSA classified.
You might be
like the Jen Van Meter one.
That's sort of where Ragdoll, they've sort of taken Ragdoll, but the rest of the issue is just sort of Jack haggling with people over stuff, and you see them go to the Mist Daughter. It's like a really weird issue because it's sort of all over the place, and like things that issue's all set up. It's all set paid off. Later, like the ragdoll stories paid off in the times past where they show the JSA having to get together to stop the ragdoll. You know, you see Miss Daughter, you know, go into action. You see what happens with the Matthew O'Dare. Is he the one who's, you know,
kind of
reincarnated? You know, he's got like the visions of the ancient Indian. You see what's happening with him. And it's a really weird issue. It doesn't
always.
Chris just pieced something together.
You actually saw the light bulb turn on?
I saw the light bulb turn on in your head. That's always my favorite issue, especially the part where he's trying to explain to his son why he doesn't like him wearing that shirt. Because it reminds, you know, there's evil behind that image on the shirt.
Yeah, it really would be like, you know, someone wearing a... I think
he mentions the Charles Manson. He's anything. It's just a shirt that people like wear.
Brought up something that, while I think this book is relatively timeless and holds up very well, there are some really funny 90s references and some pop culture stuff that gets brought up. So it does get dated in some of that. But I think that's... probably at the time, Robinson was trying to make it very relevant for that day for those readers.
For those jaded 20-year-old hipsters reading comic books.
Exactly. Sean, you?
Talking with David. That issue, just in general, that started a concept that I was totally not expecting this book to go with. David died. So when David died, I was like, what? You know, what do you mean we got an issue with David now?
And what's he doing here?
But the cool part was it was two brothers and, you know, anybody with family members or somebody you butt heads with. And there's somebody who you're not sure if you even like them. And I loved that whole concept of the whole thing. And they have to face that. You know, they have the knockout, dragout brawl the two brothers have. And they have the talk that two brothers have. And the end result is they realize that they both loved each other. Even if there were a lot of times where they didn't like each other at all.
My brothers do.
Yeah. But, you know, in this case, David's being the big brother. He has some unfinished business. You know, he led his life down one direction that, you know, he put blinders on. He followed Dad and never really, you know, identified himself. And his goal here is to kind of mentor Jack and keep him away from that.
Yeah, and say, plus, don't screw up like I did.
It serves as a great tool in the storytelling to tease things that can happen in the future. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the neat things about those yearly visits with David. They're cryptic because David's got rules that he has to stick with. But he's able to do certain things during that time with Jack. And that is one of the cool things about that whole concept. I was just kind of like, wow. And it was just, you know, between that and Times Past, that was my favorite issue. But that's one of the things with the book that Robinson wasn't afraid to step outside of the current storyline to say, here's what we're doing right now, you know, and these are some things that are going to help you later to get further enjoyment in the story. It was cool.
Yeah, my favorite talking with David's the one later when they paint a house together and they don't talk. It's all about painting. You'll see. I'm making that up. That's not true.
My favorite issue is not even with Jack. It's Ted's fight with Dr. Phosphorus.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
I loved it. It was one of my favorite lines is Ted saying, you know, I'm not an old man. I'm maybe in an old body, but you know, I'm not a worn out, you know, husk of a man. I can still do this, and it kind of reinforces what makes Starman a great hero. It's kind of like Batman in the way that it's not, you know, not the superpowers. Yeah, he's got the cosmic rod or the cosmic staff, which does some pretty nifty cool stuff. But you know, at the core, they're thinkers, and I think that Jack probably as the series goes on, what was that?
And lovers.
I'm sure that Jack probably relies on his wits more and more in the series. But but Ted was brilliant. He was a scientist, and he basically tricked a guy that had all the advantage in the world over him because, you know, he was Doc Phosphorus, who is a cool villain anyway. So, but
it was a very subtle tie. It was a nice tie into that underworld unleashed. It was like this whole story where Neron was making all the villains like powered up, and some of them it worked, Dr. Phosphorus. Some didn't quite work. This was a good one where it made sense with the villain. And apparently it also made him wear stylish period style clothing.
like, how does he smoke? Reason. I don't understand that.
Just a nice, like an old fashioned suit. Why not?
Instead of bringing up his jumpsuit.
Yeah,
that whole end story arc to this to the omnibus, it was four issues that all take place the same time from different perspectives.
Right.
Which I love that storytelling technique. But one of the things that I was thinking as I was reading it is that, wow, this was really written before the writing for the trade movement or before a lot of things were collected. This was really written as a monthly periodical. And you almost kind of needed that time in between issues. It works great as a collection, don't get me wrong, but I think the
you
having
think people these days would be like, oh god, it's the same day for 6 months. When are they gonna get to tomorrow? This is so boring.
They showed Murder 3 before Murder 2.
Oh my god.
But yeah, well, I mean, interesting storytelling device, but you know, definitely reinforced that this was a monthly comic when it came out. And I think we talked about Born Again a year ago or so, and I still feel like Born Again works better in single issues or by stopping in between those issues, because the buildup of time in between those really reinforces.
When I buy a trade, I force myself to only read one chapter a month.
One chapter a month.
And sometimes I build in delays so like I can get angry.
I haven't read this in 6 months. I'm so pissed.
You know, I follow the exact. When I read Watchmen, I waited like a year to read the last issue. I put it off to the side.
You guys ever do that? Do you buy a trade and say, you know what, I'm gonna read one issue of this a day or 1 week?
Sometimes, if I have to like think about it.
Yeah,
if I'm going to talk about it, I don't necessarily.
Well, especially if I want to start getting to the trade, because a lot of times, you know, if you're reading a decent amount of monthly books, it's really hard to delve into a trade. Mm-hmm. And unless you set aside that time to say, hey, I'm going to read one issue, you know, at a time, you're never going to get the trade going. I've got a stack full of trades that I would love to get to.
You seem like you wouldn't have that much to read.
Oh, slam on the DC guy.
I'm just saying that when I listen to the podcast, it seems like you're caught up on your reading. I'm kidding. Oh, okay, obviously. Yeah.
Believe me. As a fellow podcaster, and he's giving you shit. That is a skill that you develop over time. Oh yeah, I know what's going on there.
Whatever. Whatever. Yeah, of course.
Well, any closing thoughts before we wrap this one up? We didn't even have to fight Sean at all. I figured that he'd be like, you know,
you
I'm
told
just
me an hour.
We're like, right, this, yeah, you know, he's just getting warmed up though.
Yeah.
I mean, look.
Oh,
at
I
it.
Could keep going. Yeah,
oh, I know you could. I know.
We'll, you said an hour.
I tell you what, we will. We'll take
the
you up on
limits
that.
Limits mostly me for all the times I've bitched about being here at like midnight. Like, God, how much do we need to do?
I'm here to serve, Tom.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I tell you what, we should probably do this like our annual JLA JSA crossover, and you've been making Chicago a regular trip.
Oh yeah.
And so we should start doing this regularly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much more Starman you have to talk about. You'll be doing it for another year. I'm sure. Real quick before we wrap up, Matt, tell people about the podcast and where they can find it.
Well, my podcast is The Shades Journal. You can find it on the Reader feed, which is a collection of a podcast about characters or concepts that can't necessarily support their own show. But I think there's a show about Hellboy on there. There's a show about Fel, a show about Dr. Sleepless, a show about Iron Fist.
A show about Fel?
Yep.
The worn out, the... Really?
No, I'm just going to say, I was like, God.
It's like 10 issues.
I was going to say, is there room for a David Knight podcast in there?
Yep.
Like one.
Talk
I love
Derek.
David Knight.
Nice. David. Okay.
You can find it either at theshadesjournal.blogspot.com or thereaderfeed.blogspot.com. And in the show, I'm going to go through all 82 issues, annuals, crossovers, one shots, and then also take a few issues where the characters that appear in this book had appeared before and talk about what was the same before and what James Robinson changed. Like David Knight, he had two appearances prior to this series where James Robinson just basically remade the character.
Wiped it clean.
Yeah,
sure.
And I'm currently recorded up through issue number 12.
Okay. Awesome. Fantastic.
Do you stockpile them?
Yep.
God, I wish I need to learn how to do that.
Yeah, how often does it come out, Matt?
Try to put it out weekly.
Weekly, okay.
I only did one this week.
Really?
Well, I was
getting hate
for
mail?
A wedding. Oh, well, if they complain about that, then I want them to stop listening. Really, honestly, it doesn't matter. If you complain to me, just delete this.
Unsubscribe.
Unsubscribe.
Mr. Whelan, tell everybody knows about Raging Bullets, but I'll give you a minute here to that one person out there that hasn't listened to Raging
Peddle
Bullets.
Peddle your way, sir.
Our buzzword is brevity.
Quick. They're quick. Fast.
Wow.
They're what you must do on your commute if you are traveling to the moon.
Raging Bullets, ragingbullets.com. We're part of the CPN. There's all kinds of places you can get our podcast. But basically, we go in-depth, cover to cover, the comic experience from A to B. You know, what panels we liked, what panels we didn't like.
The stapling.
And when he means in-depth, he means that if you're one of those guys that works in a cube, in a building, mm-hmm. and you need to fill your days with comic book talk, these are your guys, because you're going to get a lot of content.
You're going to get a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. And that's good. I think you're one of the podcasts that that fits that need, and there are a lot of people out there that have talked to us before that were like, you know, do 8-hour shows because I need to listen. And Tom, like, you know, cringes even thinking about it. There are a lot of people out there that would just listen to comic book podcasts all day long, and we just aren't going to
do
8-hour
shows when they start paying for it.
Yeah, no shit.
Hey, that's why we're all part of networks and things like that too, because there's something all of us offer and bring to the table, so which is always great.
Absolutely. And speaking of other podcasts, you can listen to me ramble on a little bit more each week by listening to 11 O'Clock Comics. Lots of quacking and whiskey drinking on that. So check that out. The forum there to Bullpen Bulletins podcast.
Makes sense.
I think. Yeah, I know.
It's bullpenbulletins.com.
Bullpenbulletins.com.
Yeah, all right. I joined up on the forum. And I'm enjoying the podcast a great deal.
It's fun. It's a good time. It allows me to flex some different muscles. And don't have to lion tame as much on that one as I do here. So I know this. I think it's the headsets. The headsets have made this very
calm.
It's kicked back.
I haven't complained yet.
I know. Well, you're getting ready to. Yeah. But before you do, tell people about Tom versus JLA.
I talk about an issue of the JLA, hopefully 3 times a week. This week I only got one. I would have done one tonight if it wasn't for this, but it's like 10 minutes long, 10 to 15 minutes long. I poke fun, I hug it, I shove it.
It's all love, though. To it. It is.
I look in and I say, I love you, but I hate you, too. And then I'm almost done with that, though. I only got about 15 more issues to go, and then I'm going to do the Flash.
Nice.
Yeah.
Where are you starting with the Flash?
Right at the beginning.
Him Showcase 4?
Turtle, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I just said that now, but I will.
Are you going to break your copy of Showcase 4 out of the vault?
yeah, my copy of Showcase 4. I have to steal that. That will be coming in a showcase.
Reminder to everyone out there, Scotty Young is continuing with the Devil and Me.
Casey puts the lotion on her skin before she gets the hose again.
So check that very funny relationship and just general pop culture show. So check out
Let me
The
move
Devil
this
and Me.
I
want to thank Mark, who's not here for hosting this as always. He's out at Rosemont setting up for the show. Want to thank Sean and Jim, even though Jim's kind of just been quietly sitting off to the side here. You're going to be chatterbox whenever we go out for dinner, though, I can tell. Like, I'm ready to talk. Matt, always good to see you, my man. Always welcome to come down from Milwaukee. Tom, we hit our 1 hour mark.
Nice.
We did good.
Perfect.
All right.
Well done.
And you're out at Wizard this Saturday? You coming out Friday? Coming out tomorrow night?
I'll come out Friday night, I think. All right. Unless I'm really tired from work or something.
I'll show you where Jeff Johns and Ethan Van Sciver were eating dinner last night. Well, we can sit in the same booth.
Jeff Johns, you want to help me move this couch into my van?
Did we really stay within an hour?
Yeah,
I'm so ashamed.
Everyone have a fantastic week. We'll be back again next Monday with another full-length episode of Around Comics. In the meantime, somebody's got to say
in between time.
We'll be everywhere in
and
around comics.
Yeah.
So much enthusiasm.
I feel like I'm, yeah.
Listening to Around Comics, your source for comic book news, reviews, and opinions. If you'd like to continue the conversation about the Starman Omnibus, you can do so by visiting our forum at aroundcomics.com. And remember to check out our new Book of the Month selection, Charles Burns' Black Hole, available now at instocktrades.com. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2008.